That's Luke Donaldson on alto sax with Blues Walk, the title track from his 1958 album. Herman Foster on piano, Peck Morrison on bass, Dave Bailey on drums, and one of my absolute favorites, Ray Barreto on congas. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, there's a fever pitch in Washington, D.C. right now, trying to rustle up the votes necessary to bring the Trump Care or the American Health Care Act to a floor vote. But despite a lot of wheeling and dealing and a lot of begging and pleading from Donald Trump and others, there seems to be a great deal of resistance to passing the legislation. And it is coming from Republicans. It is understood that the Democrats have been absolutely opposed to gutting Obamacare. But it is surprising the resistance being put up by Republicans to the bill, oddly enough, because they believe in some cases that the bill doesn't go far enough to gut the Obamacare bill, and others believing that the approach being taken in the end is going to work against the intention of granting more benefits and giving greater latitude to people who are uninsured. So that is going on right now in Washington, D.C. They have quite a few votes outstanding that are not yet in the hand. And as many as about 30 defections, they're calling them, still outstanding, still unconvinced that this is the best way to go. So we'll see what happens there. And that continues. Well, I figured we'll talk about something we haven't talked about in a long time. And you may get a sense of where we're going once I get started. He's back. Who am I talking about? Bill Clinton, still selling the myth that his all but defunct, corruption-ridden Clinton Foundation saved the lives of millions of HIV/AIDS sufferers around the world through the foundation's HIV/AIDS program. The former president is one of three, quote, well-deserving, unquote, luminaries being lauded tonight at a Manhattan gala commemorating the gay men's health crisis 35th anniversary. The Clinton Foundation, the GMHC says in a news release, quote, has been battling the epidemic since 2002, saving the lives of people living with HIV/AIDS worldwide, unquote. Our guest, Charles Ortel, the leading authority on the Clinton Foundation, begs to differ. In an exclusive multi-episode series he's been doing on Lead Stories since May of last year, Ortel has exposed multiple layers of fraud within this pseudo-charity, calling the foundation and its associated programs, quote, the largest unprosecuted fraud in history, unquote. The foundation's HIV/AIDS initiative, Ortel says, tops the list. Ortel blew the whistle on Wall Street fraud in 2007-2008 when he proved that many companies, among them GE, GM, and AIG, had overvalued their stocks by hundreds of billions of dollars. And he returns to us after a long hiatus, but it was all about digging deeper into the Clinton Foundation, and we reconnect to get these stories, this new batch of stories told. Charles, it's great to have you back.
It's an honor to be back on with you, Idris. Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to have you. Well, let's start right there. It would seem that, I don't want to blame the gay men's health crisis, but it would seem that they would be aware of the Clinton Foundation's role in this area of providing help to HIV/AIDS sufferers, but apparently not. So they're honoring him tonight. Could you give us a brief tour of what we had discussed about this HIV program, HIV/AIDS program that the Clinton Foundation was running and has been running and taking credit for as being a savior to millions of people all over the world?
Certainly, Idris. So let me just begin by saying I'm not a doctor, I'm not a lawyer, and unfortunately I'm very squeamish. So the thought of me digging into this very serious problem of HIV and AIDS was not the easiest thing for me to actually accomplish, which is why I took the hiatus. But I've had the benefit now of speaking with world experts, MDs, researchers, PhDs, et cetera, and reviewing a lot of the literature, both the medical, scientific, and legal literature that pertains to this subject. And this is really an epic fraud. So let's unpack it piece by piece. The question of HIV and leading to AIDS is a question that first started being explored at great depth around 1981. And you're absolutely right, the gay men's health crisis was formed in, I think, 1982 or so, thereabouts, and has been or was an early proponent of putting intense focus on this dread disease, figuring out what caused it, figuring out how to, if possible, cure it. But in the end, leading us to a place where the best you can hope to do if you get diagnosed as being HIV positive is to extend your life by a combination of care, treatment, and taking what are called antiretroviral drugs, ARVs, in combination. So when you are diagnosed, sadly, with HIV, being HIV positive, the treatment regimes, generally speaking, seem to be that you're going to be on these drugs for the rest of your life. And indeed, today, in 2017, you will die most likely of other things well before you get full-blown AIDS. That is to say, if you are living in the West, in countries like the United States and Western Europe and Japan, in places where we have certain things that are still, sadly, not today present around the world in Africa and parts of Asia, we have electricity virtually everywhere, which means that individuals and hospitals and treatment centers can operate test equipment and can store medicine, and individuals who need this medicine can also keep it safely stored so that it doesn't degrade. These pill regimes that you take are, in some cases, quite complex, and the medicines need to be stored at constant temperatures, certain levels of humidity, et cetera. You can't put them underneath some tree in the middle of the African jungle where there's no electricity. You just can't do it that way. And you can't, guess whether the pills manufactured in some remote plant in India made it, to the bonded storage facility in India from whence they would have been shipped. If they went by boat on some boat across some ocean into some other port in some African place, let's say, and then from that inbound warehouse in the urban center out to the rural hinterland, the countries around the world are very, very different. The Western countries are heavily urbanized. In the United States, the best estimates are that 80% of the population lives in cities. Still today, across Africa, there are many places. Ethiopia, I think, is one place. Large populations spread, all over the place. where there aren't roads. There's no electricity. There are no hospitals. There are no doctors. So it's not simply a case of, you know, lowering the price of medicine is fine. And we'll get into that in a second. But actually curing people, or at least extending their lives, requires that you have competent doctors in the field and medicines that have been checked, and that, you know, people can actually follow a treatment protocol. Moreover, the tests that have been done on HIV and AIDS, many of them, originally were done in populations in the West that are all very well nourished. So, you know, it is unclear whether the test results in the early days are completely transferable into conditions where people are malnourished, where there is no clean water, where there are no clean hospitals, and where there are very few clean hospital beds and even fewer doctors. So you get into all this, it sounds like an appealing cause, and it is an appealing cause. I wish the people who are involved in it were more focused on actually curing it than on merely extending the lives. Because, you know, the present treatment mode is one in which the victims or the sufferers of this disease are basically customers, whether they pay for it themselves or insurance companies do or governments, enriching these pharmaceutical companies. That, you know, I, as an economic conservative, I've got some serious problems with the way pharmaceutical companies are run inside this country and around the world. So, you know, I look at this. I look at another revelation that I found, which just shocked me. When you look at these medical schools around the U.S., they're very tough to get into. In some cases, you know, 50 people apply and one gets in. I was shocked to see that, you know, the line doctors, and, you know, I'm 61, I have a 90-year-old father, we're dealing with certain medical problems, and, you know, when you have a medical problem, you want to speak to a qualified doctor and ideally actually also a qualified nurse or two. The last person you want to hear from is the deputy assistant hospital bureaucrat administrator. I mean, that's not what you want. I would think we'd want our emphasis going into. But when you look, as I have done now, at the Harvards and the Yales and the Columbias, what you see is they're churning out bureaucrats, they're churning out MBAs, they're churning out lawyers. What they're not churning out are doctors. And that doesn't make sense to me. So anyway, when you get into all this, the fable, and I will say it is a fable, told by the Clinton Foundation, is that they began work on this project in July of 2002. There is no evidence, not a shred of evidence, that the Clinton Foundation was ever lawfully authorized by July 2002 to fight HIV/AIDS internationally or anywhere, or do anything other than be a research facility and archive, housing the papers and other effects of Bill Clinton's two terms in office. That was its mission. It was supposed to do that in Little Rock, Arkansas. Everything that they have done other than that is ultra vires, outside their authority. And Bill Clinton only became an officer of the Clinton Foundation, the new Clinton Foundation Health Access Initiative, by December of 2009. So none of the agreements that he signed on behalf of the Clinton Foundation, I just was looking at some today that he signed on September 29th, 2006 in Ireland. None of the agreements signed on behalf of the Clinton Foundation or the Clinton Presidential Foundation or an original entity called the Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS Initiative or the Clinton HIV/AIDS Initiative, none of those agreements are lawfully valid agreements anywhere.
So now, we have been discussing the fact that many of the programs run by the foundation, and there seems to be concern in the funding community, in the philanthropic world, too, about this. Many of the programs were actually funneling money through the foundation to operating under the aegis of the foundation. This particular program was one of the most lucrative money attractors, if you will, from donors, because, of course, the cause was HIV/AIDS. The programs were targeted at African or non-white countries, and they brought in a lot of money because many countries and donors were so sympathetic to the mission, the stated mission of the foundation. how much money do you have you tracked with respect to income and revenue, since it hasn't really been reported? But how much money do you think, or have you so far tracked, that came through the foundation ostensibly to fund this mission?
Well, narrowly in the foundation itself, and there we can say that the AIDS operation, for this purposes of discussion, was part of the, quote, foundation. You are talking about probably $1 billion or more for HIV/AIDS. And the issue here is that, you know, perhaps some in your audience are sophisticated with accounting. I know most Americans are not. The rules that do apply, definitely apply to the Clinton Foundation, all of its pieces, require the Clinton Foundation trustees to procure real, incisive, in-depth audits that would have been asking basic questions, including, you know, is the largest piece of the Clinton Foundation lawfully organized as a tax-exempt charity? And if the answer is no, then you can't produce an audit. Because it's, you know, the gating question is, what am I auditing? If the trustees tell you we have a charity, if you go and check and you see it's not lawfully organized, as a responsible account, you should know that. So the what passed for audits for this entity from the very beginning, starting with actually the initial what's called a stub period, October 23, 1997, through December 31, 1997, there's no information provided on that period. Just on that defect alone, that's a minor technicality, but it's a real issue. No subsequent report is therefore valid for any of the years. But anyway, you get into the point where it's really doing this AIDS stuff after 2002, or pretending to do it, or saying it's doing it, and they provide absolutely no information of where the donor money went. For example, what countries, individual projects did it go to? There is no there's no incisive, granular, reconciled information that says, you know, we fought AIDS for children, we fought AIDS for what are called first line projects. That's where, you know, you, the first time you go out to the group who are HIV positive, a portion of those first line patients reject the medicine or don't react to the medicine. You then have to bring in what's a more expensive protocol, which is called second line. And these are all very different prices, treatment protocols. And it turns out that when you look, as I have, into what donors gave money for, some donors, Unitaid, the biggest donor, gave a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, to go for the cause of treating pediatric AIDS. And we need to think about what that means, pediatric AIDS. Long ago, medical procedures were such that pregnant women who are HIV positive, there are ways of dramatically reducing the possibility that the child would actually be born HIV positive. So the population of children who might need HIV treatment and specifically antiretroviral drugs is a small percentage of all HIV positive people. And it would be an ethical nightmare to misdiagnose out in the bush, let's say, a child, a malnourished child, let's say, as being HIV positive when that malnourished child was not HIV positive. I mean, that would really be a diabolical mistake, and it'd be the kind of thing you want to make sure by having real doctors in the field, not and an operation directed by people with deep medical training, and that is not Ira Magaziner or Bill Clinton, who were at the top of this heap. You would want to make sure that you didn't make that kind of mistake. So when you look through what passes for financial information here, people like me who have experience in the corporate world and not as a lawyer but looking at legal agreements would look at this track record, which is in the public domain, and say this is a case study, not in negligence, not in gross negligence, but in, as we've talked before, it is a massive fraud where the trustees have completely run away from their obligations under state, federal, and foreign laws. Now all we're talking about is the largest piece of the puzzle, the HIV/AIDS puzzle. There are many other problems, but this
so we have here a foundation with many different affiliated programs that it's running that has not accounted for the money it receives under the guise of a charity to do all these different things. But speaking specifically about the HIV/AIDS program, you're getting money from all kinds of sources internationally, and you're claiming that you're saving millions of lives. You have this robust program doing great outreach, and significantly, it is centered in Black countries, in Africa, the Caribbean, and elsewhere, primarily. You have no personnel to actually conduct this program. You have no evaluative tools to say whether the program is doing well or whether the program is being effective. And you're not reporting anything, but you've received so far, in your estimation, at least $1 billion. And nobody knows where it went. Nobody knows how the money was spent. Nobody knows what was achieved. What were the facts of the performance of this program? Could you talk about another side of this program that raised your hackles, which was the questions, major questions about the quality of the medications that were distributed under this program, where they came from, and to what degree were these medications effective?
Great. That's a great question. So when you operate a foundation, as the Clinton trustees have operated this mess, without really disclosing who are the people pulling the strings of the foundation, and judging from Bill's own book, My Life, from statements and interviews by Ira Magaziner, Bill and Ira Magaziner were very much involved directing traffic. Bill refers, has given countless speeches and collected countless awards and honoraria, talking about my foundation this, my foundation that. Ira has made competing claims, calling it my foundation, calling himself chairman of the whole foundation. And, one of the reasons that the attorneys general in the United States and around the world really need to focus on this is when you have a foundation run by what I would call shadow directors who don't appear on the forum, those shadow directors can have conflicts of interest, serious conflicts of interest that should have been reported that weren't. And I'll give you some examples. The drug company that I think should be shut down, and that the executives who operate this drug company and have collected billions of dollars for running need to be in prison for the rest of their lives, is called Ranbaxy, R-A-N-B-A-X-Y. Ranbaxy is a company that started out, was a long-standing company, principle being that they would make generic pharmaceutical drugs originally for the Indian market, but they mushroomed out of India, and they were doing a lot of work in the U.S. and elsewhere, but they hadn't cracked into the HIV/AIDS generic business. At the time that one Rajat Gupta, formerly chairman and the vaunted leader of a famous consulting firm, McKinsey, but now an ex-felon convicted for insider trading, was in charge of the whole firm in 2002 when Bill Clinton and Ira Magaziner got involved in this. But they were also running, and McKinsey's a massive place, they were running a project for this Ranbaxy, how to turn this Indian company into a global powerhouse. And beginning, this is public knowledge. It's been in a report that Marsha Blackburn, a U.S. Member of Congress, put out last year, very detailed report. Bill Clinton was being paid, as were members of the Clinton family, for expenses and others, by a vehicle set up by this Rajat Gupta while he was still working full-time for McKinsey to advise clients outside of McKinsey, which itself is a very strange thing to do. So monies were paid to Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and reimbursed expenses for Chelsea Clinton from 2002 to 2008. They're not disclosed on any Clinton Foundation filings, but are in the public domain. This Ranbaxy was a client of McKinsey, so McKinsey was getting paid. Chelsea was working for McKinsey at this time. And some would question, how did she get her job at McKinsey? I'll just give her a pass on that one and say she's eminently qualified to have been an associate or an analyst or whatever she was at McKinsey. But nonetheless, none of these conflicts are disclosed in any Clinton Foundation filing at any time, and they need to be. They need to be fully disclosed. Then, in 2002, the situation in South Africa was very challenging. The South African government had a view characterized in the West as being anti-fixing the AIDS problem. Others look at it and say, you know, South Africa had many, many problems, and it had a constitution that said they had to provide the same level of health care whether you were in Cape Town or Johannesburg, and they had trouble thinking through how to mount this HIV/AIDS thing. In, I think, September of 2002, Ranbaxy got an exclusive agreement to provide its generic antiretroviral HIV/AIDS drugs into the South African market, even though at that time none of those drugs will later be turned out, you later learn, none of those drugs were ever actually tested. Nobody had any idea what those drugs were, and they were in fact provided sometime after September 2002 forward. In 2003, a fact that is not disclosed in the Clinton Foundation filings but is in the public domain and is in Indian public company filings for Ranbaxy, sometime in October, I want to say 23rd or 27th, 2003, around there, the Clinton Foundation signed an agreement to promote the sale of Ranbaxy drugs around the world. Without disclosing that agreement, it would seem, in fullness, and whether people, you know, who may have benefited from those promotion exercises, without disclosing that, certainly in any Clinton Foundation filings. Then we scroll forward to September of 2004, August, September 2004. And in that time frame, the government of South Africa gets extremely concerned with Ranbaxy when they discover, I think it was a WHO notice, saying that Ranbaxy's drugs needed to be removed from the market and for serious problems. And an investigation ensued. I won't take you through the many, many pages. I mean, it's really tens and tens of pages of legal filings. But the short version is an internal evaluation results and concludes that in August of 2004, Ranbaxy hadn't a clue as to the quality of any drug that it had produced to that date. They had not been able to test any drugs yet. Ranbaxy products were distributed either directly by the Clintons or with the Clintons in an agency function around the world to many, many countries. And this process continued. Ultimately, it culminated May of 2013 in the first iteration with the FDA, Department of Justice, and others collecting a $500 million set of economic penalties against Ranbaxy. But even then, and even more recently, Bill Clinton has still been a defender of this Ranbaxy company. And I'm sorry, you know, you should not be, there comes a point, Ranbaxy has subsequently been punished since the May 2013 experience. We really don't yet know the full extent to which U.S. taxpayer money may have been used to purchase Ranbaxy products. We, as taxpayers, put money into this big pot, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and it's very clear that generic antiretroviral drugs were purchased by PEPFAR, but there has not yet been a congressional full, deep investigation of this amount of money, which is in the tenth of billions of dollars, our money, that went into these programs around the world. We have no clear understanding yet of what may have happened there. We have no clear understanding of why it took so long. The first warning signs were in 2004, and the ultimate resolution of the $500 million fine was not until May of 2013. Why did it take so long to figure out what was going on? A better question is, you know, I was meeting last week with an eminent doctor here in Manhattan who herself has to take these medicines that are only now manufactured in generic capsule form, and she's concerned. This is a famous doctor about the medicine she gets. She wonders, you know, who's really checking it. So, you know, if we're going to have an issue here to care about, you know, we shouldn't have a former president of the United States, an aspiring president of the United States, and now Chelsea Clinton taking credit for a project that has never been monitored, never fully explained, There's no causal link between their activities. There can't be a causal link between the supposed activities of this fraud and whatever may have happened to the price of drugs. If you're not legally organized and operated as a charity, you can't take credit for anything. And even if they were legally operated, organized and operated as a charity, which they categorically
we're having a problem with the clarity of your line.
Okay.
You just for a minute fell out there. Are you in a place where the signal is weak?
No, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I could. But it still sounds somewhat muffled. That's why.
Oh, okay. Let me see if I move. I'm in an atrium here.
Okay.
Let me move to a different. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, beyond all of this is a very serious question. Is the Clinton Foundation, is this HIV/AIDS program, this unsupervised or poorly supervised and poorly regulated program, to what degree are they accountable for the deaths of people suffering with HIV/AIDS, considering that the program was distributing adulterated drugs, perhaps outdated drugs, but certainly drugs that could not have been assured as being above board and fit for use?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a very serious set of problems. What these people did, the public record is very clear, is that, and Bill himself says it in his own words, that when he was originally contacted to get involved in this project, he flatly says in a book called Giving, that he did not have the staff to do the project. So he basically outsourced it to IRA Magazine. Well, you're not allowed to do that. And that should be a warning sign right away. I don't have the staff, but I'll do it anyway. Oh, wait a minute. So, I mean, that's a very risk-prone attitude. And as we discussed, this whole idea of providing treatment, it's not simply getting the cost of the drugs down. It's not like just taking aspirin actually can be tough, I'm told. But you have to have doctors, trained experts, looking at these cases. And it's not that easy to discern whether a malnourished 21-year-old is suffering, from HIV issues or tuberculosis or some other set of problems. You don't do it just by looking at people. You have to give them rigorous tests. You have to follow on activity. You have to make sure that people are actually taking their medicines. These medicines are very expensive, and therefore they're easily sold on black markets, which exist everywhere, including in Manhattan, let alone across Africa and other places that are notoriously corrupt. So, this is a kind of project that people who really care about charity should be very worried about. So in the very early days, what IRA Magaziner did is, together with Bill Clinton, they reached out to various universities. Well, you're not allowed to create what's called a formless association in a charity. You have to have a real corporate entity. And they didn't do that. And they got all these, universities who have their own conflicts of interest and have their own agendas. Both Harvard and Yale were very interested, and subsequently, around this time, dramatically expanded their campuses by making gigantic purchases and investments of land and buildings. Yale, in the case of a former, I think, pharmaceutical complex. Harvard, in the case of buying land and deciding to dedicate it to medical and scientific pursuits. So they had their agendas. They probably saw the advantages of having a former president, maybe a future president, connected to this work. And they did not, as far as I can tell, do their due diligence carefully enough on this project, because Harvard's name is all over this. Yale's name is all over this. Columbia's name is all over this. The person who is now going to be the next president of Vassar was approached, according to public records, in the 2004-2005 time frame by the Clinton Foundation, and subsequently got involved in a major way, got Yale's name involved and her name and other people's name and many people from Yale involved in a project to support the development of health facilities in Ethiopia. When you look into the question of Ethiopia, who was the leader of the country at that time and what sorts of corruption may have been going on and who the donors are that may have benefited inside Ethiopia, you have a really sordid tale. And that's just one of the places, a very poor place, very few doctors, very few roads, not a lot of electricity penetration, long-standing internal rivalries and conflicts and questions, poor controls. It's a high-risk place to operate. And that's just one of the countries. Another was, of course, Rwanda, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Haiti, Papua New Guinea, all places where, you know, careful people would be saying, now, wait a minute. You know, you're supposed to operate a research facility and archive in Little Rock. Little Rock has its issues. But controlling something this complicated, where is it going to be controlled from? Oh, you're letting some consultant control it in Massachusetts. Well, let's see the status of the filing for that consulting firm and the original entity fighting HIV/AIDS. Are there any problems there? You start looking into this, and it is one right mess. It is an indefensible mess.
It's one big, indefensible, racist mess. I want to ask a question that's right up your alley as a former Wall Streeter. You talked about billions of dollars here involved in this project, coming in and going out, but nobody knows where. Who's handling it? And that's really my question now. So a lot of money is coming in. We know they're targeting black countries in Africa, the Caribbean, and in other parts of the world. You just mentioned Papua New Guinea. Primarily black countries. They're not being this lackadaisical and careless and reckless with disseminating drugs that may or may not be legitimate, that may or may not be effective, that may or may not even be real. So I'm going to ask it from this perspective. The guy making and selling the drugs to the foundation through some stupid memorandum of understanding, which is completely meaningless, is a hugely rich person. The Clintons are quite wealthy. Have you figured out yet, or have you found out yet, who was managing this money? Where's the money going?
Well, there's some good news there. And the good news is that finally you trace after months of your effort and some of mine, I am now getting answers back from various state and foreign governments who are beginning to see what we've been talking about. And I can be somewhat specific here. One of the big early funders of this mess was the government of Ireland. I think at this moment Hillary Clinton is either returning from or attending the funeral of an IRA leader, a despicable human being, actually, in Northern Ireland as we speak. And Bill, as you mentioned tonight, is going to be attending this gala where he's going to take credit for doing something that he never did properly. And he actually should be ashamed to even show his face. And the people who are there celebrating him, you know, they should be ashamed of themselves, because some of them are very famous, good people trying to fight, and how they could select this person to honor is beyond me. But what's going on now is this morning I received a communication from a part of department in the Irish government who provided me information that allows me to complete a piece of the puzzle here. Bill Clinton and the leader of Ireland on September, I think, 29, 2006, put their signatures to an agreement binding the Clinton Presidential Foundation and the government of Ireland to doing more work. The only problem with that agreement is the Clinton Presidential Foundation didn't exist on that date in that name, and that Bill wasn't an officer of it on that date. So the agreement that he signed under Irish law is null and void and a fraud. And Irish law is kind of serious. So there's a problem with that agreement. There's a problem with the many details that I received that don't put with other disclosures of regarding the Clinton Foundation. And there's the further development that in the public domain, the Attorney General of California, Xavier Becerra, who is a Democrat, a Democratic state, has been apparently his office following this mess and sent a stiff letter to the Clinton Foundation. Now it's called the Health Access Initiative on March 13th, 2017, demanding information be submitted into the public domain concerning what foreign grants and what U.S. grants, government grants have been made to that entity. So I sent him something this morning out to him, his office, explaining that he needs to focus not just on 2015, but to go all the way back. So there's a state, a Democratic state, where a principled person may be taking a hard look and answering the kinds of questions and getting the kinds of answers. This is a stiff letter that requires them to answer in full 30 days from March 13th, 2017, or be shut down and pay onerous penalties that cannot be defrayed by that foundation's financial resources, but would have to be paid by its trustees. We can say categorically that letter is up there. If you look at the California Registry of Charitable Trusts, put in the word Clinton Health Access, and look at the last filing at the very bottom, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's in the public domain. So California is looking into this stuff now, it would appear. New York needs to look into this hard. Massachusetts needs to look into this very hard. Arkansas needs to look into it. And I think other states have begun the process of looking into it. Other foreign countries are going to start looking into this. And when you pull on this chain, when you look at the public filings, you see fraud. You don't see somebody who should be sitting in a gala collecting a prize.
What I was going for was, I'm thinking, you're getting a lot of money. This is big time, easy money. All right. You've already shown the streak of dishonesty, and all the people around you, similarly are dishonest. Is there some way with this money coming in, because they were in constant, quote, fundraising mode, did they form a financial business? Did they put the money someplace to shelter it? What did they do with this money?
Well, see, that's the reason I brought up the government's decrease, is that you and I asking questions and informing your audience about this are one thing. But I think it's very close to a place, if not already there, where governments that have subpoena power, that can force the opening of accounts around the world, can get the answers to your questions. So for any government transfer out of the United States or big Western economies, there's a record somewhere of where that money actually went. And there's a record of their wire instructions. And as people are finding out now, Paul Manafort is under, the former manager of the Trump campaign, is under an investigation of his foreign bank accounts. Once the appropriate authorities, Department of Justice, Treasury, other people start focusing on what bank accounts may have been had by the various Clinton charity names, and in many different names by the various Clinton, by the various cronies, by the various trustees, once you have governments looking at that and comparing what forms may have been filed by the Clinton Foundation, because every foreign bank account that the Clinton Foundation may have had needs to have had a form filed. And if the forms aren't there, there's serious problems. There's stiff excise taxes and penalties and criminal penalties. So there's a lot of stuff that you can get if you're a government that you can't get if you're Charles Ortel or Eutrice Leib. And what I'm saying to you is I think that a number of these governments are to a point now where they either have this information or they're going to start chasing this information. And once you start pulling on this and comparing, what is in, let's say, a charity registration form in California with what you find in a bank account, and you see the kind of discrepancies that I can see in the public filings, and you have an FBI, let's say, or you have the equivalent of an FBI in different countries chasing these records down, then the operators of these charities are in deep trouble. and the money will eventually. If the money has disappeared, the donors, the Clinton Foundation, say the Gates Foundation is a very big donor that gave many, many grants over the long life. I think between 2001 to the present, they've given close to 100 different grants. Gates Foundation cannot claim that it is run by an idiot or somebody who, you know, shouldn't have understood what was going on here. There's some very smart people at the Gates Foundation, including Melinda Gates, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and others, who should have seen this. And generally what the IRS does in other cases, when they see something like this happen, they will punish the donors as well. So and the donor, in the case of the Gates Foundation, has only given about $150 million towards this and has about $30-plus billion remaining that would be available for other disgruntled donors, like governments, who have given money to the Clinton Foundation and now see the money disappeared. They would be able to go against the Gates Foundation, go against the Rockefeller Foundation, go against the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and others that have supported this fraud.
In terms of human rights here, is there a case to be made against the foundation for committing acts that are basically inhumane, in that the foundation undertook, willingly and deliberately undertook, a project for which it knew from the beginning it could not properly sustain, it could not properly execute this project. It selected countries that are remote in terms of supervision from the international world. How are these projects going along? It knowingly involved a distributor of drugs who himself had to pay a $500 million fine on the premise that, in fact, he was accustomed to manufacturing and distributing adulterated or weakened or ineffective drugs. The Clinton Foundation gave him had an exclusive arrangement with him. Is there a case to be made here that this was a kind of genocidal act, when people deliberately seek out these countries, fully believing that they won't be caught, they won't be monitored, and nobody would know what the outcome actually has been, but they will just simply take their word for it? When the Clintons proudly say that they've saved at least 9 million lives, the question is, you know, it could possibly be that the program exposed 9 million people to possibly needless death. So yeah. Do you know of anybody working on that level with regard to the Clinton Foundation?
Well, I think there's our mutual friend Dottie Cherry, who's a biologist and particularly focused on Haiti and the tragedy there. But, you know, if you unpack the basic assertion, they saved 9 million lives by lowering the cost of medicine. There is no evidence in the Clinton Foundation filings of expenditures approaching anywhere near the amounts required to care for 9 million people on ARVs, antiretroviral drugs. There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence that Bill Clinton and IRA Magazine were 100% responsible or even 50% responsible for lowering the cost of these antiretroviral drugs. That was a project that began before the Clinton Foundation had any money. It was a project that the Clinton administration actually opposed when he was president until the very last year of his presidency in 2000. It is a project in which other actors had some success before the Clinton Foundation turned its attention to this project in July of 2002. There were several initiatives that had succeeded in bringing the cost down. There were other there are two ways of providing this medicine. There's the branded approach and the two main ways, branded and generic. Branded people had gotten together and agreed to lower the prices. Generic firms, well before 2002, were indeed experimenting with providing generic products inside South Africa and other places. And so, you know, to say that they are responsible for bringing the price down is absurd, assuming they were even legally formed as a charity, which they never were. There's just no causal link. It'd be like saying, I'm responsible every morning around 8:30 for the sun coming up. I mean, there's yes, he gave some speeches. Yes, you know, they negotiate. Then you get into how did they negotiate? It's really, there's a book by Elton John, which is fascinating, actually. You know, it's not a very deep book, but it gets into the whole process of how he got devoted to supporting HIV/AIDS, and he's let his celebrity do that around the world, including giving money to the Clinton Foundation. He recounts that Clinton's pitch was the following to the drug companies. Listen, by keeping the price high, you don't understand that you're losing patients. If we lowered the price, these patients, in essence, will be hooked for the rest of their life. So why do you want to see them die instead of serving them for, let's say, 30 or 40 years? That is not a charitable argument. That's a business development argument, and you could debate the ethics of it, but it is not a charitable pitch. The charitable pitch would be, look, I believe in this process. I have a lot of money. You know, whatever the market price is for these drugs, I will buy them at that market price, and I'll give them to hospitals around the world for free, and I'll take care of logistics. That's a charitable argument. Going to say that I can use my legendary, you know, charm and wizardry and arm twisting ability to get generic companies who have a profit motive. And the generic drug companies have not lost money doing this. They got business they otherwise wouldn't have gotten thanks to the intercession of Bill Clinton. You know, it's just, I think that when you cut through it and when ethicists on the right and the left think about deeply about this project, what they will discover is that, you know, this is the polar opposite of charity, that you can define charity by looking at the Clinton Foundation and merely saying to somebody, do the opposite of what they did, and then you will have a charity, because this is not charity. And the question of how many lives might have been killed, might have been lost here, is, you know, it's very tough to know. You know, how many trees fall deep in the forest? You just don't know. Why? Because the treatment systems in the countries where they operate, they're not robust enough. You don't
know. We'll have to leave it there for today. We're out of time. But certainly, right, we're not leaving the subject hanging. We'll come back to it perhaps next week, early next week, if your schedule permits, Charles.
I'd be delighted, Yatrice. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for the work that you do. And I tell you, I would hate to have you as my enemy. I would hate, because, I mean, you dig, and you dig very deep. Thanks so much. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, plural, at gmail.com. Tomorrow, as you know, is Free Your Mind Friday. So get your brains in gear, and we'll see each other tomorrow. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.